against the Palestinian people. And resistance movement Hezbollah has carried out new strikes against Israel's military positions along the Lebanese border. This is News. Thanks for joining us. On day 41 of Israel's onslaught on the besieged Gaza Strip, hospitals are the focal point of the regime's deadly raids. Gaza City's Shifa Hospital is surrounded by Israeli tanks and bulldozers. No one is allowed to leave the medical complex. The director of the hospital says the Israeli military has bombed the water line. He said the regime forces are present in the hospital and have stolen several Palestinian bodies. The regime's military has confirmed its raid into the hospital, which started on Wednesday. Israeli forces entered the complex, claiming that it was atop a military command center of the Hamas resistance movement. Hamas has categorically dismissed that allegation, saying Israel lies about finding weapons at the complex. Meanwhile, a doctor in Gaza has said the situation at Shifa Hospital is catastrophic.
The situation at Al-Shifa Hospital is very dangerous and catastrophic. The Israeli army invaded the Al-Shifa complex last night, and since then, we have lost contact with our colleagues, patients, and everyone inside the Al-Shifa medical complex. We are unable to ascertain the events inside the Al-Shifa complex, including violations against the medics and patients by Israeli forces.
Israel has also bombed the surroundings of the Indonesian hospital in Gaza. According to the chief of the hospital, the medical facility is now completely out of service. The Palestinian Red Crescent says Israeli tanks have also surrounded the Al-Ahli Arab Hospital. The Nusayrat refugee camp in central Gaza was also hit, killing 9 people, mostly children. Israel has killed at least 11,500 Palestinians in Gaza since the 7th of October. The UN human rights chief has said widespread outbreaks of disease and hunger are inevitable in the besieged Palestinian territory. A UN agency says only one hospital is not functioning in the northern part of the besieged Gaza Strip. The UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs says out of 24 hospitals and clinics in northern Gaza, only one is receiving patients. This says 18 hospitals have shut down and evacuated, while another 5 only provide limited care to patients already admitted, including the Al-Shifa Hospital. Lack of power, oxygen, medical equipment, bombardments have been cited as reasons for their closure. According to the UN, 3 hospitals shut in the past 3 days alone. The situation has left medical workers struggling to keep patients, including premature babies, alive. The UN says even the Palestinian Red Cross is unable to respond to calls for help to save those who remain trapped under the rubbles. Senior representative of Hamas in Lebanon says the Palestinian resistance fighters are not operating in any hospital.
There is no center or control room for Hamas in this hospital. We avoid all the hospitals all the time. The Israelis, they have said that about Rantisi Hospital and they were lying. They've said that about Al-Quds Hospital and everyone realized that they were lying. And now everyone is watching their lies, even with the support of the United States administration.
Osama Hamdan said the U.S. and Israel have aired baseless allegations against Hamas. He underscored the Israeli military's failure to provide substantial evidence to prove Hamas operation under the Shifa Hospital complex. Hamdan also examined the footage Israel's military has put on the net. The senior Hamas official accused the regime of propagating untrue stories about its bloody war on Gaza. Hamdan mentioned several cases of such Israeli propaganda. In one of the cases, an old Palestinian man was killed after Israeli media showing him being helped by the regime soldiers. UN experts have condemned the, quote, grave violations Israel is undertaking, saying there is evidence of the regime's growing genocidal incitement against the Palestinians. The group of experts also censured governments for their failure in achieving a ceasefire. Israel's bloody campaign in Gaza has been going on since the 7th of October. The group of UN experts also expressed concern over the support of certain governments for Israel. Meanwhile, the Euro-Mediterranean Human Rights Monitor has documented Israel's use of internationally banned white phosphorus more than 1,000 strikes on Gaza. 300 of such attacks were only conducted on Wednesday, targeting Beit Lahia and northern Gaza. The monitor said resorting to internationally banned weapons proves Israel's ethnic cleansing campaign in the besieged Gaza Strip. Lebanon's resistance movement Hezbollah has carried out another strike against Israel's military positions along the border. Hezbollah fired rockets and missiles towards seven Israeli military sites. Injuries have been reported among Israeli soldiers. Hezbollah and Israeli troops have been engaged in direct clashes since the 7th of October, when the regime ignited its bloody war machine to bombard the besieged Gaza Strip. Hezbollah says that it will continue striking Israeli positions until it stops the crimes against Palestinians. The Israeli military says it has killed three Palestinians near Al-Quds after they allegedly opened fire at its forces. According to the Israeli military, one of its troops was killed and several others were wounded in the Palestinians' shooting operation. The incident took place at a checkpoint guarding access to road tunnels linking the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds. The regime has intensified its bloody attacks on the West Bank. More than 190 Palestinians have been killed by Israeli forces and settlers across the occupied territory since October the 7th. That is when the regime began its onslaught against the besieged Gaza Strip. Mariam Saleh now from Beirut to tell us more about the ongoings where she is at. And for an analysis, we have Peter Ford joining us later, former British ambassador to Syria, who will join us from Manchester. All right, Mariam, what do you have for us today? It seems like, just like other days, unless I'm mistaken, the exchanges are taking place.
Yes, well, of course, not a day has gone by without any Israeli shelling against the Lebanese border towns, in addition to the fact that the resistance continues to retaliate against that shelling. Today we had basically an intensification of the resistance operations. We had at least eight targeted barracks today, and that was something that was considered maybe unprecedented. It was the first time that they launched that number of firepower and rockets against the Israeli posts. The focus for the resistance today seemed to be on the eastern side of the border. We had one or two maybe in the central part, although we did have a lot of very significant operations on the western side of the border, where the Israelis actually said they lost many of the Israeli soldiers, or they had actually casualties, whether wounded or killed soldiers, and that is considered very significant. Of course, there is some damage in the Lebanese towns, but still, despite that, you have also a lot of damage in the northern Galilee, whether the upper Galilee or lower Galilee. That region, all in all, basically, is always under the rocket fire, whether of the Palestinian resistance groups or Hezbollah's fighting and its targeting of the military post. Hezbollah has vowed, of course, that they will continue this war. Recently, Hezbollah's Deputy Secretary General Sheikh Naim Qasem was asked whether Hezbollah would enlarge or escalate the situation. He said that basically it is all the eyes are on Gaza. This all depends on developments in Gaza, and also at the same time on the Israeli conduct. If they are the ones who launch a war against Lebanon, then therefore Hezbollah will fight with everything they have. And he also said something very significant, that they are confident, as Hezbollah resistance, as the Islamic resistance in Lebanon, that they will win any future confrontation that they might have with this with the Israelis. And that was something that was considered significant as a political stance. They have full confidence, and that would show that Hezbollah does have a lot under its sleeves, and they are ready for any scenario in the future, even if it is a full-scale invasion or full-scale war waged by the Israelis.
You know, the question always remains as to what that full-scale is going to look like, the full-scale military confrontation between the two. Because obviously, from the Hezbollah point of view, unless I'm wrong, support that. It has not shown all that it has in terms of its military prowess. But are we looking at a gradual increase in terms of the intensity between the two, especially coming from the Hezbollah side?
Well, there is a gradual increase, although it is slight. It is not as much as maybe some people would hope it would be. But Hezbollah has very calculated moves, of course. They know that what they are doing is the right thing. They believe that now the whole focus is on Gaza. It is the front lines in the Gaza confrontation that should be speaking these days. They are the ones that dictate the future and the steps of what lies ahead. Hezbollah is saying they are a front which is a supportive front, not a front which is at the front line. They have stressed it many times. And they also have said that what they have shown the Israelis so far, what they have used against the Israelis, is very minimal. It's nothing compared to what they really do have. The Israelis themselves have said this. U.S. experts have also maintained the fact that they do not want an escalation of the war into Lebanon, since they believe that Hezbollah could show more potential, perhaps multiplied by 10 compared to what Hamas can have. However, despite all of this, you also hear from the backgrounds, from sources, from Hezbollah officials, saying that this is a battle for the people of Gaza, and it is they who want to basically prove to the world that they can defend their land and they can defend Gaza. So this is what they are eyeing. But of course, when that front line is in any way threatened, the resistance has said that they will be ready to defend it. And of course, like we said, I think we haven't seen more than 5% of Hezbollah's potential in South Lebanon yet.
I'm reading the news, and that is the fact that the U.S. Defense Secretary Austin has warned the Minister of Military Affairs of Israel about Israeli military actions in Lebanon, warning against it being escalated and for Israel not to do that. I'm not too sure whether we can believe that or not, or we can take that with a grain of salt, because we know the way that the U.S. has said that about the way Israel conducts itself in the occupied territories, especially when it comes to, for example, the Al-Shifa Hospital. But it goes into at length into how the U.S. does not want to have another front open up, in this case in point, with Hezbollah. Do you think we can believe the U.S. stance on this?
Well, it seems that the U.S. has a lot on its hands right now. Of course, they have the upcoming elections in the United States. They also, I think, have really studied what Hezbollah's potential is. The fact that they are a very much more muscular group than Hamas. Of course, they do have their intelligence. The United States does have intelligence of Hezbollah's capabilities. They know that they have the precise rockets that can really target the home front of the Israelis and target the Israeli institutions, whether it is the cabinet or the Knesset, and they can really inflict heavy losses upon the Israelis. We can see that now, even. The Israelis need a lot of support from the United States, from France, from Britain, from all those world powers, the so-called democracies of the world, putting all their efforts into supporting Israel in order for it to stay standing, or else it would not be able to survive. We heard this from Hezbollah's Deputy Secretary General, that he's saying that all the support is artificial respiration for the Israelis, or else they would not be able to survive. We don't know when that would stop. So therefore, the U.S. can see that if it is only against Gaza and they need to give it all those armaments, all those the weapons, the rockets, the capabilities, the Iron Dome, all that money that is being pumped into this regime, and still they are incapable so far, as many military experts say, of achieving one single military objective, then the case in Lebanon would be even more extreme. They have in the past not been able to inflict heavy losses upon Hezbollah. They have been able, of course, to commit massacres. They have destroyed infrastructure. But have they realized any or achieved any military objective? They have not. And so, therefore, in Lebanon will be even more difficult with Hezbollah's promise. And I think that there's also the other issues that play in this regard. If the U.S. had to stand in and had to step in order to assist Israel when it comes to the front lines or the confrontation inside Lebanon or any confrontation with Hezbollah, then, therefore, there would be a more enlarged, I would say, battle zone. We're not just talking about Lebanon. I think that then even the resistance in Iraq and in Yemen would have to step in even more than what they are doing right now, and they would be given the capabilities and they would be allowed, of course, to do so with the pretext that they are, of course, defending their own lines, defending the resistance in Lebanon, and they together as one unified front in the region. It's much more different than what it was in 2006 or during all the Israeli invasions of Lebanon. now we see, even as it is different in Palestine, for the first time we see that all the resistance factions in the region, whether it is Hezbollah, the Hezbollah in Iraq, the Ansarullah in Yemen, the Yemeni army itself, are all supporting and supportive fronts for the Palestine, which is fighting its own battle, of course. But I think that with Hezbollah, it's going to be even more on a larger scale, where you will see those resistance factions coming closer. We might even see, and we heard this hint from the head of the Ansarullah movement, Sayyid Abdul Malik al-Houthi. He called on the Saudis and the Emirates to only allow just a route for the fighters in Yemen to reach the occupied Palestinian territory. So then they would have to probably even invade those lands in order to reach Palestine if the Palestinian resistance is in any way in need of that stronger support, which Hezbollah can definitely extend to, even if you do have destruction of Lebanon and you do have all these threats by the Israelis that they would be doing to Lebanon and making the people of Lebanon suffer, as they are doing in Gaza. I believe the response then would be even larger than what they are seeing right now from the resistance inside Palestine. As we said, what they have seen from Hezbollah is minimal. I mean, we're talking, like I said, only 5%. What if we raise that to 50%? What could happen then? We're talking about perhaps an invasion of the Galilee. We're talking about Hezbollah fighters inside occupied Palestinian territory, in addition to their rockets, which can be fired from northern Lebanon into Israeli sites. And so that's something I think that the Israelis and the United States need to be concerned about. They're probably doing their homework right now. They're probably, of course, seeing what they can and cannot do. But it seems to be unlikely based on many perceptions of many analysts.
Thank you for that. Maryam Saleh there from Beirut. Thank you. And that is it for World News. Bye-bye for now.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
in the limelight.
The Israeli military has launched a deadly operation against Gaza's largest hospital, the Al-Shifa Hospital. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. Iran's Press TV has covered this story and tells us more. The Israeli regime has begun a military operation against Al-Shifa Hospital in the Gaza Strip, which has come to house thousands of patients and displaced people seeking shelter there from an unrelenting Israeli war. Based on intelligence information and an operational necessity, the Israeli military are carrying out a precise and targeted operation against the hospital, the Israeli military said in a statement on Wednesday, 15th of November. Targeting hospitals and killing civilians is considered a war crime. The Israeli regime has been committing these crimes in the besieged Gaza Strip ever since its attack on Gaza started on 7th of October. The Israeli regime has killed nearly 11,500 Palestinians, including more than 8,000 women and children, in Gaza since 7th of October, when it launched a war of aggression against the territory. The Israeli regime has turned Gaza's hospitals into a specific target of its military campaign, alleging that the facilities serve to house Palestinian fighters and their equipment. The Al-Shifa Hospital, Gaza's biggest hospital, has taken the brunt of the Israeli assault on healthcare targets across the coastal sliver, with the Israeli regime claiming that it houses a command center belonging to the Palestinian resistance movement, Hamas. Also on Wednesday, 15th of November, Osama Hamdan, a senior Hamas official, said the Hamas movement had a vast network of underground tunnels in Gaza and did not need to use hospitals as bases. Osama Hamdan, the senior Hamas official, said the goal sought by the occupiers by attacking the hospitals is to displace the Palestinian nation. Osama Hamdan called the Israeli regime's claims about Gaza hospitals naive and indicative of the mental status of a defeated army. Hamas has asked the United Nations to form an international committee tasked with disproving the Israeli claim. On Tuesday, 14th of November, the World Health Organization, WHO, warned that Al-Shifa Hospital was nearly a cemetery and unable to bury dead bodies, as the facility was also tackling power cuts and a lack of fuel. Also, a senior Hamas official has said the Israeli regime, which has brought the Gaza Strip under an unrelenting war, was after causing another Nakba or catastrophe, referring to the ethnic cleansing of Palestinians by the Israeli regime in 1948. Osama Hamdan, a member of Hamas's political bureau, said on Tuesday, 14th of November, the occupying Israeli regime is planning to perpetrate another Nakba before the eyes of the modern world. The Israeli regime has killed over 11,200 Palestinians, including more than 8,000 women and children in Gaza since 7th of October, when it launched its war of aggression against the territory. Osama Hamdan strongly refuted the Israeli regime's claims that Hamas was using Gaza's hospitals as bases, a claim that the Tel Aviv regime has been using to target the healthcare facilities across the coastal sliver. The Hamas official said the Hamas movement had a vast network of underground tunnels in Gaza and it did not need to use hospitals as its command centers. The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has asked the United Nations to form an international committee tasked with disproving the Israeli claim. Osama Hamdan added, the goal sought by the occupiers by attacking the hospitals is to displace the Palestinian nation. Hamdan called the Israeli regime's claims about Gaza's hospitals naive and indicative of the mental status of a defeated army. CNN cable news network has also covered this same story and tells us more. The Israeli regime said it has launched a targeted military operation against the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas early on Wednesday morning, 15th of November, inside Gaza's largest hospital, Del Shifa Hospital, where thousands of Palestinian civilians are believed to be sheltering. Conditions inside the hospital, which has run out of fuel and is no longer considered operational, has deteriorated rapidly in recent days amid intense fighting, with doctors warning of a catastrophic situation for patients, for staff and displaced people still inside the hospital. In a statement posted online, the Israeli military said it had begun a precise and targeted operation against Hamas in a specific area of Gaza's largest hospital, the Al-Shifa Hospital. It remains unknown how many Israeli military forces have entered the hospital, but Israeli tanks could be seen inside the hospital complex, according to a CNN journalist reporting from the area. "We can see them pointing the guns of tanks towards the hospital. We are not sure whether soldiers are inside the hospital building, but they are inside the medical complex with the tanks," Khader Al-Zanoun, a reporter working for the Palestinian news agency, the Wafa news agency, told CNN. Khaled Al-Zanoun said, "There were gunfire exchanges across the yard and some of the windows in one of the hospital buildings were shattered." Doctors and journalists at the hospital have described to CNN desperate efforts to keep premature babies alive and limited procedures taking place by candlelight. In a statement on Wednesday, 15th of November, the Israeli military again accused the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas of continuing to use the hospital facility, the Al-Shifa Hospital in Gaza, for military purposes. Hamas has categorically rejected the Israeli claims. A doctor inside the Al-Shifa Hospital told CNN they were given just 30 minutes warning before the Israeli military launched their operation against the hospital. "We were asked to stay clear of the windows and the balconies. We can hear the armed vehicles. They're very close to the entrance of the medical complex," Dr. Khaled Abu Samra told CNN. Hundreds of staff and patients are still inside the Al-Shifa Hospital, according to the most recent reports from the area, along with several thousand who have sought shelter from the Israeli regime's ongoing air raid and ground offensive.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
يا أيها الذين آمنوا, O you who believe, استعينوا بالصبر والصلاة.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, now let's listen to Sheikh Salim Bimji.
But one of the questions that I want to try and answer in this topic about the youth especially and this guidance which I call a give and take relationship is that why do we find youth primarily, but even older people, distancing themselves from religion, if not completely leaving Islam altogether? I'm sure all of us in this room know somebody, maybe a family member, maybe a friend, a co-worker, a classmate, born into a Muslim family, born into a Shia family, a family that would come to the Majlis of Muharram, and for some reason the young man or woman in that family no longer identifies with Islam. Right? They don't find value in the majlis. It's the same story repeated over and over again. Right? And I probably said the same thing growing up in Edmonton when I was dragged to the majlis every year, that this is the same story repeated over and over again. What's the benefit in it for me? What do I get out of religion? I pray, I don't see that I get my du'as answered. I want this, I don't get it. I pray, I don't get this. And I see all my non-Muslim friends having fun, enjoying life, partying, doing this, doing that. So why should I bother to stay within this religion that has really blocked me in and boxed me in? I can't enjoy the world that everybody else is enjoying. So why do people feel like this? And again, not just from a theory, I've seen this in my own circle of friends, people that I grew up with in Edmonton who now no longer identify as Muslims. Their name is a Muslim name. They have that connection. They might still eat cultural food, but they have lost all semblance of Islam. You know, to the point where sometimes they have told me that, you know, I fasted this Ramadan for the first time in 20 years. I've had friends tell me this, that they haven't fasted for 10, 20 years. They've just left it all. They left praying, they left fasting. Everything is out the window. Obviously, there are different reasons why people feel this way. One of them is the society that we are born and brought up in. Right? We live in a very secular society. It's over-secularized, I would say, in the last 15 to 20 years. Back in the day, people had religiosity, whether it be Christianity or whatever, but there was religion. And people had petitions in the early 80s that we want the malls to stay open, to open rather, on a Sunday. I remember those days. People had some sense of religion back then. They recognized that Sunday should be spent in resting with the family, doing church or whatever you do, but there was a sense of family, of community, of religion back then. And we know that now things have changed, not only Monday to Friday and Saturday, Sunday, it's 24 hours a day. Some of these mega, you know, mega box stores, they stay open 24/7. So yes, society plays a huge role in why many of our youth or even elders are leaving religion. Sometimes it's our own family members. One family member drifts away and they take a sibling with them. Or the mother or father drift away and they take the children with them to the path of leaving Islam. Many times it's our friends. And that's why the Prophet had said that Al-Mar'u ala dini khalilihi. A person is on the religion of their friend, on the path and ideology of their friends. So the Prophet says, be careful who you befriend. Right? Very rarely will you come across friends, again, whether they're Muslim or not, who will keep you on the path. You know, if we have those kind of friends in our lives, thank Allah that you have them. But many times your friends will want you to be involved in what they're doing. Drugs, alcohol, sexual promiscuity, whatever the case may be. Our friends will be into it, and unfortunately even so-called Muslims, and they will drag us with them into that pit of not only hell in the world to come, but hell in this world, because you will have to pay the price for your decisions in this world. Another reason why people leave Islam is because they're not given the true, correct understanding of this religion. Whether that be from people who have not studied Islam in the traditional seminaries, and not only traditional seminary studies, but have worked on purification of the soul, because believe you me, I have seen, and I'm sure many of our scholars have seen, people who have gone to Qom, gone to Najaf for 5, 10, 15 years. They have turbans on which are 12 meters, 15 meters of material. Massive turbans bigger than your tires on your SUV. And they're the most deviant of people. They're misguiding people. Not because they didn't study. They studied great, but they didn't maybe have that purification of the soul. They weren't there for the right reasons. It was about money. It was about power. It was about establishing themselves as the head of an institution, as an organization. And so many times we lose our religion because we're not given a clear picture of it. I remember many, many years ago, this is like more than 20 years back, a young man told me that he was on the brink of leaving religion. And we were talking about many different things, and one of the things he said is that his parents have been feeding him all of this information over the years, which didn't make sense to him. It was illogical how Islam could have certain things, some certain beliefs. And I asked him for a couple. And one of the things he says, well, I'm into sports. I'm into a lot of different activities and sports. And I'm told that I'm not allowed to do sports. I said, well, why would that be? Are you dressed inappropriately? Are you playing games with the opposite gender? What is it? He goes, no, I'm told that if I jump on the ground, if I play basketball and I'm shooting hoops and I'm, you know, jumping, because I'm landing on the ground with my feet, the ground will complain to Allah on the Day of Judgment that this guy was jumping on top of me. And he said, what kind of a religion would pass that kind of a ruling, a fatwa, that I can't even jump or play sports because now the ground will complain that I jumped on the earth? It was a simple thing in my eyes, but for him, because sports was his everything, he thought this doesn't make sense. How can a religion which encourages, you know, us to be active in archery and horseback riding and swimming and sports and, you know, all of these things, how can it then put me in a position of being accountable to God on the Day of Judgment? And people tell me other stories that they hear from their parents. Not because their parents meant bad, but because for the most part, these parents came with very little sound knowledge of Islam. They came from communities and countries where they didn't have scholars educating them. So the point being is that many times we end up mixing religion and culture to the extent or completely providing illogical rulings that our youth especially begin to leave Islam. When they see that culture is saying one thing, no, you can't marry this person because they're not from our tribe back home. Because you're a Sayyidah, you can't marry a non-Sayyid. Well, what about Ayatollah Sayyid Muhammad Reza Gulpaygani, the late? He married his daughter to a sheikh, to a non-Sayyid, Ayatollah Sheikh Lutfullah Safi Gulpaygani, marhum, who passed away recently. A marja taqlid, who's a Sayyid, he marries his daughter to a non-Sayyid. And you look at the Imams of Ahlul Bayt, right? They married women from Nubia, from Africa, from Morocco, from the Northwest Africa, from Sudan. If you believe the story of the 12th Imam marrying Narjis Khatun, there are alternative theories. She was from Rome. She wasn't a Sayyidah in the lineage of Banu Hashim, but yet the Imams of Ahlul Bayt, the 12th Imam's mother, apparently she's from Rome. So she would have been of Christian descent, Caucasian. She wasn't a Sayyidah in that definition. But yet we have this cultural baggage. No, if the boy isn't a Sayyid from this village in Pakistan or whatever country, then you can't marry him. And so then our youth will do whatever they want because they have needs that are not being fulfilled through the religious permissible ways because culture has destroyed our religious identity. And then we wonder why our youth don't want to follow the religion. Well, we have convoluted culture to such an extent that it's completely blurred. Where does culture end and religion begin? There's no way to identify that for many people.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Rahi Kareem Adi Alim Hali Hakim Mati.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
A new survey has found that the number of American households reporting tumbling incomes is growing. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. According to RT, the number of U.S. adults with declining incomes has soared in recent weeks in a sign of a weakening labor market. And that was according to a Bloomberg report. Bloomberg added, the share of households facing a drop in their incomes rose from 10.7% in August to 11.8% last month. Citing a survey of the U.S. labor market by data intelligence company Morning Consult, the increase was mainly driven by high and middle income families and the West region of the United States. About 20% of adults polled who earn $100,000 or more annually reported that they expected their incomes to drop in the next 4 weeks. RT added, the share of employees who reported working over 35 hours fell to 46.7%, representing a 12% drop from September 2022. The decline marked the lowest level since the spring of 2021, signaling a slowdown in U.S. business activity, the survey revealed. The most cited reason by respondents was soft business conditions. This comes as U.S. inflation-adjusted household income fell by the most in 12 years in 2022, highlighting the toll of a higher cost of living and the expiration of pandemic-era programs. The income and poverty data released by the U.S. Census last month showed how deeply the U.S. economic conditions were affected by the COVID-19 crisis and the government's response to it. The measure of child poverty more than doubled following the expiry of pandemic-era child tax credits last year amid the worst inflation in 40 years, which has undermined household spending power. In another report, RT wrote, as Uncle Sam continues to pump billions of dollars into Kiev's flagging fight against Russia and provide tempting handouts to illegal migrants, why is the average American worker forced to live paycheck to paycheck? Here's a question that most people have considered at least once in their lives and probably a lot recently. How much annual income would you need to feel financially secure? For the average American, the magic number comes out to be $233,000 a year, according to a survey by Bankrate. To bring the 99% back down to earth, The U.S. Census Bureau released some sobering data that dashed those elusive six-digit dreams. Inflation-adjusted median household income fell to $74,580 in 2022, a 2,300 decline from 2021 average of $76,330. This marks the third straight annual decrease since the COVID-19 pandemic began in 2020, taking a wrecking ball to the heart of the economy. The bad news doesn't end there for U.S. consumers, who are now struggling with the consequences of a foreign conflict in a distant land and a wide open border. Those factors have prompted the cost of living to surge higher than it has in over four decades amid runaway inflation. In June 2022, the year-over-year inflation rate, as measured by the Consumer Price Index, hit a jaw-dropping 9.1%, the highest it has been since the administration of former President Ronald Reagan. A significant reason for the increase in inflation happened on March 3, 2022, when President Joe Biden signed an executive order to ban the import of Russian oil, liquefied natural gas, and coal to the U.S. This decision has had disastrous results for the local economy. Since Biden's inauguration, the cost of gasoline alone had jumped at one point by 100%. As of September 27th, the average price of regular gas was $3.832 per gallon, according to the AAA, while gas prices were an average of $2.3 per gallon when Biden entered office, forcing just about everything else to skyrocket, including the number of poor people in the U.S. The poverty rate in the U.S. exploded last year, the first increase in 13 years, and that was according to the Census Bureau. In 2022, the rate was 12.4%, up 4.6 percentage points from 2021, according to the Supplemental Poverty Measure, SPM, a method for tallying government welfare programs and tax credits designed to assist low-income families. Meanwhile, the expectations index, determined by consumers' short-term outlook for income, business, and labor market conditions, sunk to 73.7 in September. That follows a drop to 83.3 in August. The worrisome part is that an expectation index below 80 generally indicates an impending recession. An economic tragedy is already quietly happening for millions of American consumers who are now living paycheck to paycheck precariously and who have been forced to use the payment method of last resort to make ends meet. The almighty credit card with its exorbitant interest fees. On this score, the U.S. economy has broken yet another record, although not in a way that could be considered something to cheer about. The Street reported U.S. credit card debt rose by $45 billion to $1.3 trillion in the second quarter from the first quarter, a 4.6% quarterly increase. The Street added, it's the first time in U.S. history that household credit card balances topped $1 trillion mark as the number of credit card accounts expanded by 5.48 million to 578.35 million in the quarter. When consumer debt suddenly equals the amount the U.S. spends on its military-industrial complex, you know there is a problem. Clearly, the U.S. has some serious domestic issues that need to be resolved, but instead, it would rather fund a totally senseless proxy war against a nuclear power halfway around the world. Washington has given Ukraine close to $100 billion in aid, with more in the pipeline, since Moscow launched its operation in February 2022. The cash, however, has not only been used to fund Ukraine's military. Billions of dollars have subsidized participants of the Ukrainian economy, like farmers and small business owners, market players whose counterparts in the U.S. desperately need help too. A recent study conducted by the Council on Foreign Relations shows that more than $30 billion, around 40% of total U.S. aid to Ukraine as of July 31st, has been financial or humanitarian assistance that is not directly connected to military support. Military funding comes out to around $50 billion.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1930 to 2030 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAD 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
The issue of Palestine is the first issue of the world of Islam by Ayatollah Khamenei. The issue of Palestine is the world of Islam's top priority, November 23rd, 2017. Today, the issue of Palestine is the first issue of the world of Islam. Anyone who has a correct understanding of the issue of Palestine acknowledges that the issue of Palestine is the first issue of the world of Islam. The key to defeating the enemies of Islam is the issue of Palestine. The most important issue of the world of Islam in the present time is the issue of Palestine. Why is that? This is because Palestine is an Islamic country. They have come and occupied this country. They have taken it away from its people. The issue is not about usurping a village or a city. The enemy has usurped a country, and it has used it as a base for jeopardizing the security of regional countries. One should fight against a cancerous tumor. Notice that if a person issues a fatwa as a religious mufti saying that the fighting against Zionism is haram, that helping such and such a group which is fighting against Zionism is not allowed, this is really a disaster to witness that some people in the world of Islam are acting against the interest of Islam and have friendly relations with the enemies. This is the exact opposite of the Quran's clear words. Those who are with him are strong against unbelievers, but compassionate among each other. The Holy Quran, chapter 48, verse 29. However, those people are strong against Muslims, but compassionate among unbelievers. They are on good terms with them, but notice what they are doing to Muslims.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Forgetting the issue of Palestine is the enemy's goal. December 17, 2016. If Muslims are united, Palestine will not be in the situation that it is in now. Today, Palestine is in a difficult situation. Gaza and the West Bank are in a difficult situation, both in different ways. Today, the people of Palestine are under serious pressures on a daily basis. They want to erase the issue of Palestine from the minds of people and co-sign it to oblivion. They want to, as they say, busy the West Asian region, including our own countries. This is an extraordinarily sensitive and strategic region. It is a sensitive region in terms of geography, natural resources, and sea passageways with themselves. They want Muslims to stand up against Muslims and Arabs against Arabs. They want them to target and destroy one another so that the armies of Muslim countries, particularly those armies that are neighboring the Zionists, weaken on a daily basis. This is their goal.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.